From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we have Michelle Flournoy. She's one of the preeminent defense experts in the United States, widely known as one of the top strategists, thinkers, and authorities on defense policy. She served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration. And for purposes of this podcast, she was the Obama transition team's lead person dealing with the Defense Department during the Obama transition. Michelle, welcome to Transition Lab.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here and honored, and it's a really important topic.
So my first question for you, Michelle, is when during the Obama transition process or during the Obama campaign, when were you tapped to work on that process and who asked you?
Ironically, I was actually on a study tour visiting Iraq when I was called. I got a phone call asking if I was okay being one of the 100 or so people who would be pre-cleared to work on a transition team if the candidate won. And so that was in the fall, a couple months before the election.
You were asked to be the lead to deal with the Defense Department. And when did that happen and when did you start your work?
And so once President Obama won the election and they were putting the transition team together, at that point I was asked to co-lead the Defense Department transition.
Oh, so you actually weren't asked to do that before the election?
Obviously, I sort of knew that I'd be contributing on national security and defense, but in terms of actually leading the team wasn't until after the election in my recollection.
And so what did you do in that role? Like, what was your job as the lead on the agency review team?
Well, the first thing was to put a team together, and some people were assigned, meaning these were people who had already worked on the campaign, who had identified themselves as experts in defense, and so I was given a list of people to incorporate. And then based on my assessment of what we needed to cover, I started suggesting additional names of people we could bring in who would be very, very helpful. And then I remember meeting at my house to sort of do a little mini offsite to try to come up with a strategic plan of how we were going to work. What were we going to cover? How were we going to divide up the labor? What were the deliverables going to be? You know, how were we going to use the very limited time we had to do a good job?
So you obviously had worked in the Pentagon. You know a lot of people there. During the campaign, you knew you would have a role in the transition. Did you talk to people in the Pentagon, or was that a no-no?
That was a no-no.
Okay.
So there's really no official contact with members of the transition team until the White House and the outgoing administration and the incoming administration sort of negotiate a memorandum of understanding governing the transition, and then you're sort of invited in to the department. But I want to say up front that to their credit, the Bush administration, at least in the Pentagon, did an incredibly professional job on the transition.
Yeah, widely. Josh Bolton did a great job across the government and organized the entire
government.
We
were received with kind of red carpet treatment and very well supported.
And did you come up with lists of people that could be good candidates for different roles, or was that separated from the agency work?
So there was a separate person who in charge of putting together the slates of candidates for different jobs, but we certainly made suggestions, but that was a separate effort.
So Secretary Gates writes about this in his book, Bob Gates, which is in any transition, the people that come in kind of think they're smarter, they're better, they have a little swagger, and they say, you know, we're in, we're out. And did you have that swagger or did you try to avoid that swagger?
We tried to avoid that swagger. We talked as a team about approaching this professionally and with some degree of humility that we were there really to listen and learn and then start formulating our own sort of suggestions for a way forward. You know, many of us knew Gates from his former life, and, you know, I think he commanded a lot of respect. It was very clear that he was brought in late in the Bush administration to try to turn around the Iraq war, and that had been his focus. So, you know, I don't think there was too much arrogance walking in the door.
But one of the unusual things about that transition was that you went in and you're meeting with Gates, and he knew something that you didn't know at that time, which was that Obama had already asked him to continue on as Secretary of Defense.
President-elect Barack Obama is reportedly keeping Defense Secretary Robert Gates in his job for at least a year. The 65-year-old moderate Republican with long-standing ties to the Bush family would fulfill an Obama pledge to include a Republican in his cabinet.
Was that awkward for you, or did he hint that maybe that was happening? Or
nope, he's great, got a great poker face. He did not let on at all. Eventually, it became known. But you know, the truth was, we were deep into doing an assessment of what was happening in the department. Where were things going well? Where were they not going well? Again, what was the president going to inherit on day one that we needed to highlight from the start? What would the first 100 days look like, and so forth? So we just were going about our work. And then once it was clear that Gates was the appointee, then we developed a briefing for him. And the main message was, you know, he used to go up to the Hill in the Bush administration, say, my top three priorities are Iraq, Iraq, and Iraq. And we basically made the case to him that in this new incarnation as Secretary of Defense, you've really got to broaden the aperture. There are lots of issues with the budget, with the program, with modernizing for the future, and other areas that you've got to take on.
So this was the first transition to a new president where there was a war going on in four decades. How did that affect your transition?
It gave us a great sense of responsibility and urgency to really understand where we were on Iraq, but also on Afghanistan. Remember, once Iraq started in 2003, Afghanistan essentially became an economy of force mission. And frankly, it started going downhill. So President Obama inherited a deteriorating situation in Afghanistan that required sort of immediate attention. So we did spend a fair amount of time on that.
Now, Obama ran in part against the war. He voted against the Iraq war. And then Gates was one of the people that was brought in to fix all the problems. Mm-hmm. But wasn't it awkward to deal with a secretary who became your boss, where the president had basically run against the policies that Gates was formally implementing? How did that work?
Well, I think Gates had been brought in to try to change the trajectory of the war, and that did happen on his watch. And by the time Obama came in, the Bush administration was already implementing a phased transition approach, which means that, you know, they had built up the Iraqi security forces. They were starting to hand off responsibility for certain provinces as certain conditions were met. And so a lot of, the core thrust of the Iraq review was to continue that process.
One of the things that you've talked about post-government experience in the Obama administration is the importance of teams.
Yes.
You wrote a great essay for the University of Virginia Miller Center on transitions, and you said that the president not only needs to pick great people, but he needs to pick teams of people that work together. Why is that so important?
Because the chemistry on the team, the complementarity of skill sets and experience can make things go very smoothly or very badly, depending on, you know, on the composition. So I think paying attention to that, trying to ensure that you have people who can work well together. Not that you have groupthink. You want a diversity of backgrounds and experience and perspectives, but you want people who are able to check their egos at the door and focus on the mission and work together as a team.
And one of the things that Gates and you did was actually send up a slate of candidates to the Hill, which we think is best practice. So I think that the president sent up five or six nominees for the Gates Defense Department under Obama. In early January, they were confirmed very quickly. And was that something that you did by design, or is that something that just happened?
Well, I think because of the sense of urgency that we had two wars ongoing, even before, I think it was before the election or just after, there was a deep discussion with the Senate Armed Services Committee, and they basically said on a bipartisan basis, look, we are going to put priority on confirming your top team quickly because we understand that a gap is dangerous for us. I would have loved to have seen that from an interagency perspective as well. Ended up going to Afghanistan on day five because I'd spent a lot of time on Iraq, but never in Afghanistan. And I had the benefit of having access to an aircraft
right.
that could get me in there. Had I known then what I know now, I would have invited all of the other deputies from other agencies who were going to be involved in the Afghanistan review to come with me, because I think that would have been very useful to do a fact-finding tour together.
But a lot of them weren't actually in place.
A lot of them weren't in place. Right. And again, it just wasn't exactly known who was going to be on that team.
Right. So You're saying that you actually went up to the Armed Services Committee, or someone did, prior to the election, and talked with them and said, we want to get our people confirmed if we win.
Yes. So that was, I think, a discussion between the transition team and possibly folks from the Bush administration as well. I think this was something that was, you know, they did some writing about and speaking about, and the SASC stepped up and committed.
Now, is there something unique about that transition on the national security side that is distinct from transitions in the civilian agencies? Are there more vulnerabilities? There's more pressure. What do you think is unique?
I think at a time when you're involved in active combat operations overseas, and there are active threat streams in terms of terrorist attacks against the United States, there's a sense of vulnerability, and that we really have to do this as professionally and carefully as possible and as urgently as possible. So, no, I do think it's different.
And do you think our enemies or adversaries think that there's a vulnerability in the country during a transition that they could take advantage of? And did you see evidence of that?
Sure. I mean, there were active threat streams on Inauguration Day that people were worried about. We've seen in other cases attacks happen as transitions occur. So, it's a time where hundreds of, actually thousands of people are literally walking out the door, and their replacements have not walked in yet.
And so how do you deal with that in a best practice perspective?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, you try to accelerate the confirmations of people coming in. I do think it's a good best practice to designate certain key positions and, you know, ask people to stay in their jobs and do a direct handoff to their successor. So don't just leave the job open, but ask people to be holdovers. And I also think something that's now in law is you have the outgoing administration host the incoming administration with a tabletop exercise. And they actually did one, Bush to Obama, again, very well done, where you had left and right seat, you know, cabinet official and cabinet nominee doing a scenario-based exercise about an attack on the American homeland.
So many of our listeners won't know what a tabletop exercise is. What does that mean?
So it's basically a scenario-based, structured conversation where you walk through the stages of a scenario and the critical decisions that would have to be made each step along the way. You know, if on day one or day two something happens, people have some idea of the resources at their disposal, how decisions will come to them. They've kind of been through it at least once before.
One of the best practices in transition planning has been the security clearances for the agencies, and that stems from the 9/11 Commission report, which looked at what happened on 9/11. And a lot of the Bush people were not in place in September after President Bush had taken office. So they recommended that transition teams post-convention get as many people cleared as possible. And I guess in the Obama campaign, there were about 200 cleared. How does that process work? And does that lead people to think, oh, I'm going to get cleared, so I'm in good position to get a job?
Well, it certainly leads people to believe that the president wants you, or the presidential candidate wants you as part of the transition team. And I do think it's a very important practice. Less important for some of us who've spent a career in the field and maintain our clearances, but for new people coming in, very, very important. Taking the transition team jobs, I think you have to do it in its own right. And there are some people who can't serve in the administration, but they want to help the president by just working on the transition. But I think most of the people who work on the transition did a good job, and who want to serve were able to find jobs.
So you went in through this unusual period where you were planning to the Obama takeover of the Defense Department, and you have a boss that was there before, mm-hmm. and he nominates you. You mm-hmm. develop great chemistry. He also kept a bunch of people from the Bush administration until the Obama people came in their seats. How did you fill out the rest of the team, and how long did that take?
Well, I understood that that had to be my top priority, that getting the team in place really demanded my attention. The truth is you're doing your job during the day and meeting the demands of the secretary and the president, the NSC process. But at, you know, at every free moment and at night, I was looking at resumes and right. trying to make decisions. The easiest thing was to hire the deputy assistant secretaries and below because they did not require Senate confirmation. One of the advantages of being confirmed early is that I was the first one with hiring authority. And I could, had that kind of the pick of the litter. And that was one of the reasons I was able to build such an incredibly stellar team. So you have your sort of more junior staff in place first. And then, you know, 6 months, 12 months as the assistant secretaries start rolling in through the confirmation process, you have to figure out how to make room for them and really leverage their talents as well.
One of the things that president-elects need to decide is how their structure of government will be organized. Will there be a strong White House? Will there be government run by cabinet agencies like President Carter did, which didn't work so well? The Bush administration had a very tight, centrally controlled government. And the Obama administration, many would say, tighten that even more. And one of the things you write about in your Miller Center report is that the agencies should be giving much more latitude in national security space. So is that recommendation as based on your experience? And why do you think that's important?
Well, I think the role of the NSC is to really support the president in his or her decision making. You know, to run the interagency process, the NSC process, to tee up options for decision, to staff the president as he makes those decisions, and so forth. But when it comes to policy implementation, that's why you have presidentially appointed, Senate confirmed cabinet secretaries who have, you know, responsibilities and authorities in law to drive that policy into execution. And I think the best way to actually ensure policies are faithfully executed is to hold those cabinet members and the other political appointees accountable, as opposed to having a small White House staff trying to get inside a, you know, an agency as large as the Pentagon and do the job for the secretary.
And so what would you advise a new president, if there were a new president in the next year or in the next 4 years, on how they should structure their NSC versus the national security agencies?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to have a conception that has the NSC as an honest broker that is ensuring that you get the best available information to inform your decisions, including any dissenting views, because dissenting views can help you make better decisions, can help you mitigate risk if you're ruling against that dissent. But also that you also have role clarity, and that you sit down with your top team, your cabinet secretaries, your national security advisor, and you talk openly about what is the division of labor? What do you need from each person? What's their lane? What are they accountable for? Where should they not stray into the lanes of others?
One of the things that happens in every new administration is that a lot of campaign people get jobs. I've seen that throughout government and other agencies. Does that happen in the Pentagon, or is the Pentagon pretty immune from campaign people coming in and taking jobs?
I think a lot of the folks who came into the Pentagon were experts on defense, but also worked on the campaign. It does require a certain degree of professional experience and expertise. It's not a place where someone who's a complete neophyte on defense will come in and do well. I think it tends to draw more people with more of an expert or experience-based background.
One of the things that gave the Bush administration freedom of action to hand it over to either Obama or McCain was that there was no vice president running for office. So the existing vice president wasn't running, which was the first time in decades. This year, we have a challenger running against a Republican administration. How will this transition be different if the Democrat were to win?
It is hard to say, because the Trump administration coming in did not have a strong transition process, and I think that's an understatement. I don't know if it was because the president didn't expect to win, or didn't like the work that the initial team did, or what have you, but it was a very messy and chaotic transition. And so they don't have their own experience to draw on in terms of how to prepare to welcome someone else in. So in that case, I would hope that they would pull in the people who've done it best, people like Josh Bolton and Dennis McDonough or John Podesta and others who have been part of really successful transitions, to pull them in and get their advice on how to do it right.
The other thing the Trump administration is doing is planning for a potential second term.
Sure.
So what should a president do in year four to prepare for year five, since year five is typically in a time of significant turnover in personnel, significant policy innovation, policy productivity, because the election just happened? What should the Trump administration be doing now to plan in case they win a second term?
I think they have to plan as if they're not starting over, but you have to once again think in a new four-year chunk and set goals for that time. And on the personnel front, very difficult because you've gone through the obvious bench. The White House personnel organization has still ruled out a number of Republicans who originally signed Never Trump letters. So their bench is getting thinner and thinner. And so one of the key challenges they're going to have if the president were to win a second term would be simply populating the ranks of the political appointees unless they change their policies on which Republicans they will and won't accept.
What were the biggest surprises that you dealt with when you came in to the administration after carefully planning a transition in 2008?
That's a great question. I think you never fully appreciate the extent of what's happening operationally, particularly in the classified domain, until you get that first in brief and realize, wow, I saw some of this in the newspapers and so forth, but some of this that there's a things like the extent of the threat streams we were seeing against the U.S. homeland in terms of potential terrorist attacks at the time was much more concerning than I had a sense of from the outside, for example.
And did you think the new team was ready when you got there and saw these horrific threat streams?
I do. I think most of the people in senior positions had, had some experience before, and there were a number of both career professionals and people who were asked to stay on, people like Mike Vickers in the Defense Department, who were very deeply expert on counterterrorism.
You stayed in your position 3.5-ish years, and is that about the right time to serve? I mean, these are exhausting, high-pressure jobs. Your husband had a high-pressure job. You had three kids. Was that about the right time? Do you, in hindsight, look back and say, I wish I stayed longer, or I stayed too long?
Yeah, I wish I could have stayed longer. We had one child who had some health issues that, just required my attention or our attention. So I wish I could have stayed longer. But actually, the average turnover for a political appointee is something like between 18 and 24 months, mm-hmm. which is way too fast. Mm-hmm. You have to be in one of these jobs 3-4 years or more to really have enduring impact on the institution. You can change policies quickly. You can be part of those processes. But if you're really trying, I was trying to, I had a big human capital strategy when I was in policy in OSD, and I was working hard to kind of change the culture and how we take care of people and how we develop people. That is not something you do overnight. It takes time. So I would argue for longer commitments if you can get people to make them.
Now, when you started your career, you were interested in defense and national security policies. You had a distinguished academic background. Did you think that you would achieve these great heights in government service?
Absolutely not. I had no idea. And this is what I always tell young people, that you can't plan this. I felt very blessed to have the opportunity to serve, and particularly to have the opportunity to serve people like Barack Obama and Bob Gates and Leon Panetta. I tried to share it with my family as much as possible and tried to, even on the hard days, step back and be grateful for the opportunity.
And you were excellent in your job and have an impeccable reputation. But one of the unusual things is you're a woman. And the most senior.
It's not so unusual.
It's unusual in the Pentagon.
Yes.
And you're the most senior female ever to serve in the Pentagon. So when you started your career, did you think you were going to be a trailblazer for women in the national security space?
I didn't set out to be that, but I did find myself from the beginning in rooms where I was the only woman. I started my...
Every day, I assume.
I started my work working on nuclear issues, nuclear weapons, nuclear arms control, nuclear proliferation. And it was sort of the gray-bearded priesthood and me in a lot of my early jobs. And so, I think that got me prepared for it. But it also got me committed to trying to have some impact on changing it. I mean, I think all of the business literature says that the more diverse the teams, the better the decisions, the better the performance of the organization. And so when I did have a chance to, hire a team, I really tried to bring in a team that looks more like America. Mm-hmm. And that had a greater diversity of background and perspective and experience to help us all make better decisions.
In the national security space, you've had female secretaries of state, but never a female director of head of the Defense Department, now we have a female at the CIA. It's gotten better, but it's still one of the least progressive areas in terms of gender opportunities. Do you think that's going to continue to change?
I think it's changing. When I was a young professional in the Bill Clinton administration, I remember we had a senior, women's leaders lunch, a female leaders lunch, and there were like eight of us at the table, and everybody was staring like, "What are all the women talking about?" Fast forward to the Obama administration, we would have filled the executive dining room.
Right.
With female leaders in the Pentagon. So it's getting better. It needs to get better
still. A lot of work to do.
And particularly needs to get better in terms of minority representation.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one other question?
Sure.
Had you worked with the Partnership of Public Service in transition planning either pre or post your transition work?
I did work with them when the second Obama administration was getting started. The president asked me to put together a first 100 days training for new officials coming in. Also did some work with the partnership in terms of their transition training programs.
Well, Michelle Flournoy, I look forward to the day when you have the opportunity to serve our country again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dana.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.